And one of the things I was thinking about for this retreat is I know that St. Francis and St. Dominic were great friends. They were good friends. And I think it's going to be interesting to have an introduction from a Dominican on such a great saint as St. Bonaventure and how that's going to intertwine and how both disciplines are going to be, I'm sure, fully enacted here. So I'm excited about that. And also for the spiritual enrichment that we're going to experience here for contemplation, for those who are going past the verbal and mental prayer. We're going to go into something I think is going to really broaden our experience as faithful Christians. And I'm very excited about Father Rooney here, you know, and is working on his doctorate program. And I know that you're working in Chinese and you'll do that. Okay, I won't get into all that. And I know that you'll have but anyway, thank you very much, and we appreciate you coming.
Thank you very much. So as he said, my name is Father James Dominic Rooney. You're welcome to call me Father James, Father James Dominic, Father Rooney, whatever is most comfortable to you. So I'll just start with the sort of the obvious question, who am I and what am I doing here? So as he said, I'm a PhD student in philosophy at St. Louis University. I do a very complicated sort of thing, metaphysics. And I do Chinese philosophy and medieval Latin philosophy. So Bonaventure falls on the medieval Latin philosophy side. But I'm here not to talk to you about his philosophy, but about his theology, his mystical theology, what he has to tell us about the spiritual life. But a little bit more maybe about me. So I'm a Dominican friar, and as he said, the Dominicans and Franciscans were founded at the same time in the 13th century. I myself am from Ohio originally, so I'm living in St. Louis, though, doing my doctorate, and I'm in that area with the Dominicans. We Dominicans have, you know, the center here at Indiana University. We have the campus ministry, St. Paul's, so you're most welcome if you'd like to see other Dominicans and not be so prejudiced against the one that you've met. You're welcome to find another Dominican you like down the road at Dominicans R Us. So the weekend is going to look maybe a little interesting because I'm focusing a bit more on what you need, and I'm not sure what you need at this point. I'm afraid I've just stood up here behind this podium, and I don't know who all you are, so I'd love to meet you all, and you're most welcome to tell me maybe after the conference what you're looking for in the retreat, what kind of things you want. If you want to meet a little bit with me on the side, that's perfectly all right. My room is going to be the one 103, which is like right next to the office. So you're most welcome to stop by if you have any questions or anything else. We do have quite a lot of time, I think, for confessions and that. Let me get the schedule here. We had confessions today, and we had Mass today. I guess I was a little off thinking that this evening's Mass was sort of open to the public. I wasn't sure exactly what the connection would be between my Masses and the schedule here. So I sort of preached, I changed my homily because I thought, well, everyone's going to be here, so I shouldn't just preach to retreatants. But it looks like, I thought we had confession every day. We don't, it looks like. But you're most welcome to, as I said, come grab me outside of the times on here. But the other thing that's sort of important that I'm trying to think about when we schedule our retreat, when we're getting into the right spirit of it here, is not only am I available for some one-on-one time with everybody, I think the number two big rule is to try to keep talking to an absolute minimum. We're going to try to do a very nice silent retreat, at least a quiet one. So there's certainly good... good things that need to be said when necessary, so we'll do that. Nobody's at fault. But we're going to try to keep a very quiet, prayerful spirit is sort of the idea. The retreat is going to be a walk through this beautiful spiritual work of St. Bonaventure called the Itinerantia Mentis ad Deum, the journey of the mind to God. And I'm going to read some of it even to you in a little bit. But the beauty of this work is it's a spiritual journey with St. Bonaventure to the place where St. Francis received the stigmata. That's sort of the premise of the book. And I'd like you to think, as we're starting this journey together, I'll talk more about the book, but we're going on to the mountain. We're going into the darkness together, into the silence, to be with Christ, to be with Francis and Bonaventure, to contemplate God together. And it's going to be in quiet and darkness. And so we're going to kind of get into that tonight in a very visible way with this sort of darkness outside. We're we're literally in the dark, but we're also going to spend some time every night, you know, in adoration. That's the most important part of this retreat, is those moments you get one-to-one with Jesus, less with me. So one of the things I'd also like to sort of qualify on the schedule, there are times when we have tomorrow the rosary in the morning at 8:15 and the chaplet of Divine Mercy, and the same on the last day. I guess I just want to say those times, you're most welcome to come. I'll lead the rosary, but just don't feel obligated. So I'm just going to kind of make those optional. So you're most welcome to take a little extra time for private prayer those times, or even you can sleep in a little bit. But you're most welcome to take a little extra time for quiet. I know the rosary can be kind of busy. I don't want us to just kind of add more busy stuff, is sort of the idea. So you're most welcome to come to every time or none. Okay. We're taking time to be silent. Who was Saint Bonaventure, and why should we care about this book? Why does it lead us into this silence? A little about Saint Bonaventure first, and maybe his connection to us poor Dominican friars. So, as I said, the Dominicans and Franciscans were founded around the same time in the 13th century. Many of you are probably devotees of the Franciscans here, so I'm sure you get a lot of Francis, but I'll supplement it just a little so that we call it to mind. Francis, the great poor man of Assisi, leaving everything to follow Jesus, he doesn't set out to found a religious order, but to follow the words of Christ to him, Francis, rebuild my church. And hearing those gospel words, if thou would be perfect, give all thou hast to the poor and come follow me. This great message inspires Francis, and seeing him and hearing those words inspired other people to join and follow him. And in fact, I think Francis was rather not sure what to do with all the people that came to him. Initially, he set them on rebuilding churches. Only later did he come to realize that maybe what Jesus meant was to rebuild his church with a capital C. Francis, sending people to preach, to set a good example, to preach without words, to live the apostolic way of life in poverty, following Christ, to practice love and charity toward others, to be a general force for good in the world, to follow the example of Christ without gloss, without anything to mitigate what Christ says in the Gospels. It's a beautiful call of Francis. But I think we might know Francis was never a very good leader. He was always the lesser brother, and he always gave up responsibility to other people to run the Franciscans, sometimes to people who were maybe not the best at it. Francis was a great inspired person. As his life came to an end, he turned over more and more authority, and his Franciscan order, even within his own lifetime, started to be divided against itself. He had, to a great extent, no particular way of solving those disputes except to love and pray for his brothers. His great final act was going and making a special Lent where he tried to imitate Jesus, to go up Mount Alverna and to fast for 40 days like Jesus did. And it was there near the end of his life, as he was contemplating all the divisions and problems that were happening in the Franciscan order, in that moment that I think probably, from what we might gather, was probably one of darkness for him, not being sure what the future was going to hold, not being sure if the order would continue. It was in those moments that Francis on the mountain has this vision of a seraph with six wings coming to him as the crucified one, and the rays of light pierce his hands and his side and his feet, and he carries the mark of the stigmata on his body for the next few years until he dies, until his transitus. That great spiritual experience of Francis carrying the cross is something of the opposite of Francis in some ways. Bonaventure, we don't know much about him in his family life. We get his family's names, his parents' names, but we don't know anything really about them. We know that Bonaventure's original baptismal name was John. We don't know why it got changed to Bonaventure. There is sort of a legend that Francis cured him of an illness and changed his name, saying something like, "Oh, good fortune." That's what Bonaventura means in Italian. But in fact, there's no evidence for that. What he does say, though, is that his devotion to Francis is from a very young age. He writes in his Legend of St. Francis that while yet a child, he was preserved from death through the intercession of St. Francis, and that his family and he had a devotion to Francis from very young. He eventually does enter the Order of Friars Minor, the Franciscans. He enters in about the year when he's about 18 or so, 17, 18, 20. It's not clear. He went from where he was, where he joined, which was in the Roman province in Italy, and he was sent to complete his studies at the University of Paris. The University of Paris is where all of the great theologians of the Middle Ages taught. It was the great big university like Oxford. At that point, Oxford was a little bit more backwater than Paris. Paris was the big university. That also indicates Bonaventure was probably a smart guy. He got sent there to work with one of the greatest theologians of the Middle Ages of that time, Alexander of Hales, who was also one of the early Franciscans. He was a professor of theology who joined the Franciscans as a professor. He became a Franciscan. It was at that same university that he received his licentiate, which is like a master's degree. And after receiving that under Alexander of Hales, there was a big controversy that broke out. And it was also at this time that St. Thomas Aquinas finished his licentiate in Cologne, Germany, and moved to Paris and joined Bonaventure there. At that time, though, they had just come and were doing their doctorates in theology together at the University of Paris. And the worst thing that could possibly happen to a PhD student happened, which was there was a movement among the professors that there were too many of these Franciscans and Dominicans running around, and we need to stop giving any of them doctorates. So there was a movement that the secular priests, the diocesan priests, ran the university. And the university was like a diocesan institution, and they were very afraid that if they were going to hand out too many doctorates, the Franciscans and Dominicans would take their positions, because that's what already happened. Alexander of Hales had one of these tenured positions and had become a Franciscan, giving them the tenure position, and they only had about 10. So the other professors were worried that they weren't going to get tenure. So this is scary for academics. But it had a very bad impact, right, on Bonaventure and Thomas, who ended up getting hung up in their studies completely unintentionally. And the controversy got worse as time went on, because one of the main actors in this controversy started saying the Franciscans and Dominicans were the forerunners of the Antichrist and things, and got very hyped up and excited. When the controversy finally was ended, it was in 1257, October 23rd, when Thomas Aquinas and Bonaventure were both awarded their degrees in the same ceremony on the same day. I don't know if we have Bonaventure's doctoral address, but we do have Thomas Aquinas's. I don't think we have Bonaventure's doctoral address, because this happened at the end of October when he was given his doctorate. In February, while this whole thing was carrying on, he was elected Minister General of the Franciscans. So he probably was not there in person to receive his degree or to have many long addresses for his doctorate. I'm not sure. I just say that. But it certainly wouldn't be surprising. His job as Minister General of the Franciscans was, as I said, after Francis's death, not an easy one. Because already in his life, this is 1257 when he is elected Minister General of the Franciscans, Francis has only died about 30, 40 years. I forget exactly the date of Francis's death. He's only died maybe 30 or 40 years before. And already two parties have broken out in the Franciscans. The sort of Latin names are the spirituales and the relaxati, the spirituals and the relaxed. And they don't mean people that like to sit in chairs and drink margaritas. They meant people who were accused of not wanting to follow the full rule of St. Francis, who wanted to make exceptions for poverty, for example, that maybe you could carry some money at some points in time or do things that were slightly against the rule. Of course, the controversy went back and forth, and it got caught up in all sorts of, like the problem at the university, got caught up in all sorts of other things. A vision of the future of the church. There was an abbot, Joachim of Fiore, who predicted a future church coming. There'd be no priests or anything. And this was the forerunners of the perfect church, were the Franciscans, and you just got to be strong guys and, you know, be very clear. Bonaventure takes over in the midst of these infighting about poverty, about obedience, about what they're supposed to be doing as Franciscans. And the thing that's impressive about Bonaventure, even though these divisions persisted after his life, Bonaventure held a very clear middle course. He is sometimes considered like the ancestor of either the OFMs or the conventuals, but he sort of held the order together. And he was very effective at it, from everything that can be said. He was a very effective administrator, unlike Francis. He held the order together, and his constitutions that general chapters under him passed made a sort of reconciliation between both positions. He was a great peacemaker, and that comes out a number of other times in his life, but it happens most in the sort of central part of the Franciscan order, not compromising, I think, anything of St. Francis's vision. When you read the life of Francis that he had commissioned, that he drew up, I think you get the same sorts of spirit. Francis was a peacemaker, and the order of Friars Minor is to be the lesser brothers, humility. If the church changes, we sometimes have to change too. Our job is to serve them. One of the controversies was even him teaching, right, was something that became somewhat controversial with the spiritual branch, whether they could accept posts in universities and spend a lot of time teaching when they could be doing other things, contemplation, or it seemed that they needed big buildings, right, in the centers of cities if they're going to teach at universities and have lots of students. So you get into controversies over poverty that are connected with this. And Bonaventure pointed out St. Francis's words were that one should not engage in study so that it quenched devotion. But that doesn't mean one can't use study to fire one's devotion. St. Bonaventure was a clear example of that. His theology and his study was entirely at the service of the love of God. In his writings, he sees theology even as an exercise in coming to know the person you love more, coming to know more the person you love so that you can love them more. His theology is a sort of clarity of love. We want to clear our eyes so that we can burn more for God, so that we're not distracted. His theology, though, after he became Minister General, he was also then eventually appointed to the Archbishopric of York in England. He was made Archbishop of York, but he declined because he already had a lot of work to do. And then he was appointed a cardinal. and his workload got even more. And so theology ended up taking a bit of a back seat after about his 36th year of age. He had quite a lot on his plate, but you see immediately and consistently at all of those points in time the great love of God he had and how it continues to inform everything he did. Because even in the midst of all that intense work, he puts out beautiful works like this Journey of the Mind to God. It happens that he continues to put out these small mystical works later in his career, even after he had been unable to do the larger works of scholastic theology. He, as a minister general, and then later as a cardinal, continues the work of reconciliation. He was put in charge as a cardinal of one of the ecumenical councils, the Ecumenical Council of Lyon, which was to reconcile the Orthodox churches with the Catholic churches. And under Bonaventure, he was entrusted with the whole proceedings. And he did manage to work out an agreement, theological and charitable, hopefully. And it did not last after his death, but his great work was remembered as being a reconciler, somebody who brought peace at that council. And it was probably for that reason that we now are pretty sure he was poisoned. After the council was over, he was poisoned, and that seems to be the reason for his death in 1274. He was probably poisoned because of the success of his endeavors and how he had brought about peace and sort of continuing rancor against the Union. After his death, though, he was very much remembered as a sort of a living saint. People during his life were fairly positive about his sanctity. The story goes, when he received the cardinal's hat, indicating that he was appointed, he was washing dishes and told the papal legate to put the hat on the nearby wash rack until he was done. So he was not a very self-conscious man, and you also see that in his writings, because he clearly, in his theology, doesn't offer any final solution to all theological problems that you could possibly pose. He's very humble, and he collects a lot of opinions and tries to find the good in other people's positions. He's never one to sort of just disregard other people's positions, but to always see the good in them. So you get a sort of feeling of Bonaventure from some of that. His theology, though, even during his life, miracles and great stories about him. Alexander of Hales, who was his Dr. Vater, his director of his dissertation, as it were, his teacher. Alexander of Hales was said to have said of St. Bonaventure before Alexander of Hales died that Bonaventure was the only man he met who had never been infected by Adam's original sin, that he was a completely innocent and beautiful soul. St. Thomas Aquinas is said to have come to St. Bonaventure's cell to ask him some question or to present him some comments on something he wrote. And in visiting his cell, he is said to have found St. Bonaventure in ecstasy. And he turned to his other companions and the other students that were supposed to have the appointment with Bonaventure, and he said, "Let us leave a saint to the work of a saint," and closed the door. Told them the appointment was canceled. The life of Bonaventure is beautiful, and I think we can find so much in his theology that indicates that beautiful picture of the world. His love of God is at the center of his theology. So why might a Dominican like St. Bonaventure, and how does he differ maybe from that other great friend of Bonaventure's, Thomas? I think this is a nice thing to think about. Thomas, I'm very fond of, and Thomas is very good for clarity. Thomas does have some mystical writings and beautiful homilies that you can find on the Hail Mary or the Our Father. Thomas is very, very clear, but Bonaventure is very clearly drawn away by love of God. Even in the midst of his scholastic treatises on very complicated questions of metaphysics or logic, you find Bonaventure slipping into ecstasy. And you can kind of see it in the writings. He's clearly, completely engrossed in the love of God. And you see sometimes that works into his method. Where St. Thomas is maybe more analytical, St. Bonaventure sees the big picture and is more struck by the big picture. It's not opposed to what Thomas is doing. It's just that that's how he is. He's struck so much by the big picture. Thomas was trying to reconcile a lot of scientific thought from Aristotle and the Muslim theologians, Averroes and Avicenna, and doing a great work of synthetic reasoning. St. Bonaventure tended to stick to Augustine, St. Augustine, the great theologian from Africa, from Hippo. And he's very much drawn into that same way of doing theology, where Thomas is systematic and logical and scientific. Bonaventure is often interested in the interior life and the interior experience and the way we know the world, as opposed to just the sort of logical. So they sort of start from different points. St. Thomas, I like this phrase. St. Thomas was the teacher of the schools. St. Bonaventure inflamed the heart. St. Bonaventure inflamed the heart. St. Thomas extended the kingdom of God by love of theology, Bonaventure by a theology of love. I think that's very much the sort of picture. I think his beautiful theology, it would be great to go and read a little bit more of his theology if you ever have time. Not everybody needs to be a theologian, but Bonaventure is the example of that kind of theology that you read and you could use it as chapel meditation, right? It's just beautiful. So that's a little bit of St. Bonaventure, who ends up with the title, perhaps unsurprisingly, the Seraphic Doctor, the doctor that's like the seraphim. What is the Itinerantium Mentis Ad Deum, this beautiful book we're about to jump into? As I said, Bonaventure is struggling with, even in the midst of all these divisions in the Franciscan order, this book is written, I think, after he's stopped teaching. He's beset by so many troubles in governing the Franciscan order and everybody fighting against each other. And he's trying to find inspiration to guide the order. And not only that, I think he's trying to find a little of Francis's own spark and try to put that at the center of his life. He goes on a retreat, as it were, to Mount Alverna, where Francis received the stigmata. And I think this is right before they're writing the legend of Francis, the life of Francis. He goes up on the mountain, and he himself is trying to meditate on that experience of the seraph and what the seraph means. I'm going to not regale you too much with my interpretation of Bonaventure's ideas. I'm going to just start by reading his own introduction. As I begin, I call upon the first beginning, the Father of lights from whom all illumination descends, from whom every good gift and every perfect gift derives. I call upon the Eternal Father through his Son, our Lord Jesus Christ, through the intercession of the most blessed Virgin Mary, mother of this same God and Lord Jesus Christ, and through blessed Francis, our leader and father. Give light to the eyes of our mind, guide our feet into the way of peace, that peace which surpasses all understanding, that peace announced and given to us by our Lord Jesus Christ and preached by our Father Francis. For he proclaimed peace at the beginning and at the end of every sermon. He offered his wish of peace in every greeting. He longed for ecstatic peace in every contemplation, as a dweller of that Jerusalem of which the man of peace says, "He who was peaceable with them that hated peace, pray for the peace of Jerusalem." At the example of our most blessed Father Francis, I too was seeking peace with a longing spirit. I, a sinner, unworthy in all my ways, who yet had become the seventh Father General of the Brothers of Friar Minor, after the passing away of this most blessed father. At a time close to the 33rd anniversary of Francis's departure from this world, it came about by divine prompting that I walked up Mount Alverno, longing to find some peace of soul at that place of peace. While I was there meditating on the different ways of the mind's ascent to God, there came to me, among other thoughts, the memory of the miracle which had occurred in this very place to Blessed Francis himself, the vision of a six-winged seraph in the likeness of the crucified one. In my meditation, it was at once clear to me that this vision represented not only the contemplative rapture of our Father, but also the road by which this rapture is attained. The six wings may rightly indicate 6 degrees of illumination, or 6 steps or paths, along which the soul may reach peace through the ecstatic leaps of Christian wisdom. There is no path but through that most burning love for the crucified, which so transformed Paul, the apostle, when he was carried up to the third heaven that he could say, "With Christ I am nailed to the cross. It is now no longer I that live, but Christ that lives in me." This love also absorbed the mind of Francis, so much so that his spirit clearly shone through his flesh. Indeed, for 2 years before his death, he carried in his own body the holy stigmata of the Passion. Thus it is that the symbolism of the 6 wings of the seraph suggests 6 ascending steps of illumination, starting with creatures and leading all the way up to God, to whom there is no access except through the crucified. For he who enters not by that door into the sheepfold, but climbs up another way, is a thief and a robber. But if anyone enters by this door, he shall go in and out and shall find pasture. Therefore John said in Revelation, "Blessed are they that wash their robes in the blood of the Lamb. They have a right to the tree of life and may enter in by the gates into that city." As if saying, no one may enter the heavenly Jerusalem by contemplation unless he goes in through the blood of the Lamb as through a door. First, therefore, I invite the reader to cry out in prayer through Christ crucified, by whose blood we are cleansed from the filth of sin. Let's not believe it is enough to read or listen without unction, to speculate without devotion, to investigate without wonder, to observe without joy, to act without zeal, to know without love, to understand without humility, to strive without divine grace, or to reflect as a mirror without divinely inspired wisdom. To those who are favored by divine grace, to the humble and the holy, to the repentant and the devout, to those anointed with the oil of gladness, to lovers of divine wisdom, to those who wish to dedicate themselves to the glorification, praise, and enjoyment of God, I propose these thoughts that follow. I am supposing that the mirror offered by the outside world is of little or no value, unless if the mirror of your mind is not clear or polished. Therefore, listener and reader, train yourself by listening to the goad of conscience before you lift up your eyes to the beams of wisdom reflected in the mirrors of that same wisdom, lest you fall into a deeper pit of darkness for having gazed upon such light. It seems fitting for me to divide this work into 7 chapters. Please consider the writer's intention rather than his performance, the sense of his words rather than their lack of polish, the truth presented in preference to the style, the training of the heart more than the erudition of the mind. To this end, let us not hasten through the development of thoughts, but dwell upon them at due length. We're going to ascend the mountain together. There's only so much we can say. I have a few thoughts on what St. Bonaventure is going to tell us tomorrow. We're going to do 2 wings of the seraph each conference tomorrow. We'll ascend a little bit at a time in the world outside, in the world inside, and then into that invisible place where only God dwells, the Holy of Holies. That's our itinerary for tomorrow. The rest is up to you. As St. Bonaventure will tell us, the journey here is really one from outside to inside. We come here together for a little retreat. We're together for a few days. Let's make use of that time to try to find the silent voice of God speaking to us inside, to find Christ in that darkness and dwell with him. That's our task, and it's pretty simple. We have a little time now for adoration after this. You'll have some quiet time now, maybe even in these future conferences. I might not go the full time to give you a little bit extra time at the end. As I said, you're welcome to speak with me maybe after, introduce yourself, but we're going to try to be relatively quiet. Thank you.